The Rising Coaches Podcast is brought to you by Just Play Sports Solutions. Are you still giving out paper scouting reports to your team? I'm talking about the two pieces of paper stapled together with the player's picture on it and a couple sentences about how they like to shoot from three or is a straight line driver. We can do so much more with our scouting reports, and Just Play can help you do it. How does it work? Your players download an app right to their phone, which they're on 24/7, right? Through that app, you can upload all kinds of content, not just scouting reports, but video analysis, game plans. You can assign who they're going to be guarding and let them watch personnel clips. You can make it interactive. You can have your players answering questions. You can throw in quizzes, and you can monitor their use, who's using it, and for how long. And the best part about Just Play is it's cheaper than their competitors. It is a no-brainer. For more information, visit JustPlaySolutions.com. Just Play Sports Solutions. Teach faster, prepare better. Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. This is Adam Gordon, and today we have a very special guest, head video coordinator for the Detroit Pistons, TJ Saint. TJ talks to us about Stan Van Gundy, Brad Stevens, and Rick Bird, three Hall of Famers who he has all worked for. Then we get into a really great X's and O's discussion, talking about different ways to defend and play. Really good stuff. It was a really fun conversation for me to have. And you can just see from hearing him speak the passion that he has and just how much he loves basketball and loves to coach and loves to explore different facets of the game. And I think that'll come across. We've gotten a ton of great feedback from the podcast so far. Please keep that coming. We love hearing your comments, topics for discussion, questions to ask, guests you'd like to see on the podcast. Hope you enjoy this one. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. All right, we are joined here today by TJ Saint, video coordinator for the Detroit Pistons. TJ, thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. TJ, you're going into your fourth year with the Detroit Pistons. Before that, you spent some time at Butler, spent time at Belmont with Rick Bird. You've pretty much just surrounded yourselves with Hall of Fame coaches. Can you talk a little bit about the three guys that you've worked for, Brad Stevens, Stan Van Gundy, and Rick Bird, like maybe some similarities, some differences, what makes those guys tick and what makes them great?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if I necessarily surrounded myself with those guys. I think I got very lucky with the right place, right timing to get in a position to work for each of those guys. But just starting off with Rick Bird, and I'll tell you a quick story, is I was a walk-on at Mercer University, which is in Macon, Georgia, for 2 years. And I probably shouldn't have done this, but I was actually, we just finished practice and we were exiting the gym and Belmont was coming in about an hour later. And I told Coach Bird this and he laughs now, but so we're playing Belmont the next day when I was at Mercer and the Belmont team comes in and I'm actually standing at the top of the gym kind of watching. I watched how they walked in. They all had the same warm-up gear. They didn't have any headphones on. You know, they walked in together. They seemed very unified. And I was like, wow, you know, I felt like that was a big reason, their unification on why they kind of ran through the league every year. And so I watched a little bit of them warm up, talked to them for just a second and then left. And I was really, really impressed with how Coach Bird ran his program, just from that standpoint, let alone getting beat by him every year in every game. And so when it came time the next year, my coach in college, Mark Sloniker, got let go and they hired a new coach. So I decided to transfer. And I actually just on a whim, I wrote a letter, a handwritten letter to Rick Bird. I scanned it and I emailed it to him. And he responded within a week, I think, got back to me. And he actually had read the letter that I wrote to him, to his team. I found that out because I ended up transferring the semester and working for Belmont as a student assistant until I finished my degree. And he actually read the letter, you know, to his team, talking about the, you know, some a kid who, you know, playing at a rival school but wants to work here and yada yada yada. And I was just very impressed with them, and Coach Bird's a great mentor for me. I'm actually going to see him in about a week. We're going to go up to Boston for a clinic. Coach Stevens is doing a clinic up in Boston. And then I spent my time there, and he gave me some of the best advice going into my senior year. In the summer, I used to work for a company that's still around. It's called Point Guard College. And I was planning on doing that again. You know, you make some money, you coach. It's a great experience, great teaching. But he gave me some great advice, and he said, well, you want to coach, you know, you want to coach in the NBA or high college level, you need to make contacts. And I said, well, how do I do that? And he said, you need to work college camps. And I was like, okay. So then I got on the horn, and I started emailing and writing different DOBOs and GAs and assistant coaches trying to get into college camps, and probably worked 10, 11 that summer. And you know how it is. You kind of go from place to place. They pay a little bit, and that money gets you to the next place, and then that money gets you to the next place. So at the end of the summer, you break even, but you meet a lot of people and you coach, and it's a great, great experience for guys coming up through the ranks. And one of those places I worked camp was Butler. And what I kind of found out with the name, and, you know, being here at the Pistons now, I get two or three LinkedIn messages a week from people who want to work for us, or I get a letter here and there, maybe a couple times a week, from people trying to work for us. But it's a lot of times people I don't know, people I've never met. And the advice I give to everybody is put a face with the name, because by working the camp, I think the summer before at Butler, the next year when I was looking for GA spots, you know, they'd seen me work. I knew them. I'd stayed in touch with them. You know, Coach Bird helped me get there. And then the kind of the rest going to Butler was history. And it was, I was very lucky. But I think putting a face with a name is probably the biggest component with that.
Did you know, like, going into college at Mercer that you wanted to coach? I mean, how long? You seem like a guy that's kind of known that for a while.
Yeah, so I actually decided, this is kind of a funny story too. I actually decided when I was 7 years old that I wanted to play in the NBA, and then I wanted to coach in the NBA, be a successful head coach in the NBA. And so my first goal, I just had two goals. First goal is to play and be the backup point guard for the Charlotte Hornets. It did not work out.
I like how you were modest with your goals and just the backup point guard. You didn't have to be the starter.
Well, you know, I played AAU and I played with some really good players, and I knew I was probably at the backup level at best, maybe make a 9-10-year career. And I loved my dad's based. He flew for U.S. Airways. He was based out of Charlotte. I loved the city, and that was my goal. I didn't get it, like I said, so I moved on to the next goal. And I'm still trying. Got a long way to go, a lot to learn, but trying to be a, you know, a successful NBA head coach one day.
How old are you now, TJ?
29.
So I'd say you're on the right track. It's been 22 years, and you're in the NBA, head video coordinator. So you're moving in the right direction. All right, so you get to Butler, work for Brad Stevens. What was he like?
Unbelievable, still is. Another, just like Coach Bird, another great mentor for me. You know, and he's obviously the head coach of the Celtics now, and is very busy, has a lot to do. And, you know, I'll ping ideas off of him every now and then, or, you know, when he's in town, I'll see him, or like this clinic he's having, I'll see him every summer. But just a great mentor, a guy who literally from day one just threw me in the fire. I remember we played Louisville. It's my first year as a GA. We played Louisville. It was definitely, I think, our first home game and maybe the second game of the year. And, you know, a week before, he said, you know, TJ, I want you to, you know, watch all their different presses and come up with a game plan for their presses and present it in the meeting to the coaches. And that's kind of going to be your thing. You got to let me know during the game their different tendencies and calls and which presses they're doing. And I was like, wow, you know, that's something that I wasn't necessarily thinking I was going to be responsible for, but just – from day one, just letting you make mistakes, letting you succeed, putting your face out there, you know, making you able to present in front of people. I owe that guy a lot. He really helped with my development. Such a great guy too. You know, one of the quotes that I don't know who originally said it, but he would say it from time to time is men. Let me make sure I get this right. Men do not attract that which they want. They attract that which who they are. and the people he surrounds himself are just like him, great people. And it's no coincidence that he's having the same success that he had at Butler, now at the Celtics. Just a great person, great coach, really gets it, understands the family side and when you need to get away and recharge, and really good at empowering people around him, I would say.
How many years were you there at Butler?
I was there for three, so I was a GA for him for 2 years. And then Matthew Graves, one of our assistant coaches, got the head coaching job at South Alabama. He's still down there now, and he took our ops guy, Darnell Archie, with him. And that opened up a couple spots, and he hired a guy for the assistant coach, and then he bumped me up from GA to ops. And then about 3 months later, he took the Celtics job. And I stayed in ops. We hired a new head coach. And then the year after that, I got quite lucky again and got a chance to come here to Detroit and fulfill the NBA dream.
Yeah, so you're there in Detroit working under Stan Van Gundy. Tell us about him.
The most organized, forward-thinking person I've ever been around. Our staff meetings and the way he organizes them and puts them together is something I've never seen before. I mean, we'll walk in and he's got everything broken down of what this guy needs to get better at, what he's already good at, what are we doing with this, how are we guarding this. And he's a really good facilitator of discussion. He's, you know, I was just talking to him today. I just got back from vacation and we had a few guys in for workouts, and just his mind, and we've got meetings next Monday and Tuesday to prepare for September workouts and training camp, and just some of the stuff he's thinking about for this year, which I can't really go into all of it, but some of the things he's thinking about and ways to guard, you know, special star players versus, you know, a guy right here. He's a pioneer on the defensive end of the basketball for sure. I mean, it's been a great experience. I learn from him every day. He's made me a ton better.
Is there like a common trait that those three coaches share, or something that they all do or are all great at?
Yeah, for sure. The first thing is they're all great people. I mean, Coach Van Gundy has been awesome with me. Like in my position, it wasn't a position where the moving expense was actually paid for when I first got here. And he said, hey, whatever you do, I'll write you a check. And I got there the first day when I started, and he wrote me a check for my moving expenses out of his own pocket. And then I would say all these guys, they surround themselves with great people. Like I said, like Coach Stevens quote, men do not attract that which they want. They attract that which who they are. And it's so true. The people they surround themselves with, I would say for sure they're great people. I would say the second thing is they do the work. You know, everybody's looking for a more efficient way to do things. And for sure there are, you know, technology's gotten better even in the video software in the last few years, but the magic is in the work. You know, there's no substitute for putting in the hours and preparing. Those guys, all three of them in different regard, are ultra high on the preparedness level. And the final thing I would say is they let their people under them do their jobs and let them go. You know, they just let them do their jobs and let them be free and push them. And I can't, you know, I'm sitting here. I feel very lucky to be in Detroit right now. I feel very lucky to have worked at Butler and Belmont for three great guys and three guys that, you know, obviously I work for Stan now, but the two other guys, I bounce ideas off of. They're great mentors for me in making different decisions. And so is Stan. And I'm very lucky and really excited for this season, to be honest.
Tell us about, like, what's a typical day for you, let's say, in season? What's your day like? What's your schedule like?
Yeah, so I'll take a practice day, I guess. So our practices start at 11 a.m. That depends on if we play the night before or not. So let's say we didn't play the night before. We're going to start at 11 a.m. You know, I'll get to the facility. I live pretty close to it, about 7:30. You know, I'll either be doing part of the edit that we're going to show the team from the next day or working on some other future projects. And then at 9, we have a coaches meeting. It's always 2 hours before practice starts. And we'll be in there anywhere from 15 minutes, could be an hour or more, depending on the day and depending on what we have to do.
Right after that, usually grab some breakfast. We've got, you know, a chef in-house who, for breakfast and lunch every day, that they make whatever you want. And right about 9:15, or excuse me, 10:15, about 45 minutes before practice, we have different guys coming onto the court that we like to get, you know, 15 to 20 minutes of player development. And a lot of the young guys come in early before practice, and some of the veterans tend to do their player development after practice. And so we'll work with different guys. Sometimes I'm, you know, I'm working out certain guys that I'm assigned, and the other times I'm just helping assistant coaches with whatever they need on the court with their players. Right at 11, we'll either start and film and watch film from whatever we need to, either, you know, the last night's game or not, or then we'll actually come out and we'll practice. And during the season, it's funny, the differences between college and NBA become stark here is, you know, we might only practice once a week because we're playing four times a week, or we might practice twice. That'd probably be the max. So the practices, even when we do it, aren't very long. They might be an hour, hour and 15 minutes, and then we're done. And so then after practice, you know, there's a few guys who get some player development in, and guys who don't play as much during the season, who also don't go to the D League, we usually try to do 3-on-3 or 4-on-4 with them after practice, and it's reffed and everything like that. And then after that, it's about 1 o'clock, 1:30, you're kind of done for the day. I mean, you work on your projects you need to, you know, I'll get a workout in on my own. And then you're just kind of done for the day and managing yourself. You know, Coach Van Gundy doesn't put an hour restriction on you, just expects you to get your work done and your work to be really good.
What are those film sessions like with the team? Are they pretty brief? Are they long? Is it, you know, calling out the team on certain things? Does coach, you know, will he call out certain individuals? Tell us about like a film session.
Yeah, he holds people accountable very well. I mean, I think that's one of the quickest ways you can kind of start losing a team is if you call out or you hold accountable player A, and you don't hold accountable player B on the next clip or two clips from then. He's really good at being democratic in his accountability and who he holds out. And the biggest part is he holds himself accountable almost more than any coach I've ever seen. And I've worked for Rick Bird and Brad Stevens, and they both do the same thing. And Coach Van Gundy is right there with them, but he'll hold himself accountable. The film sessions aren't as much of a, they're not screaming or yelling or anything like that. They're all periods where he can teach, or an assistant coach can teach. We view them as teaching sessions because, you know, you can scream till you're blue in the face over what happened last night, but it's over. You know, we use those sessions as to critique and teach for the next time to try to make better decisions. And, you know, those sessions, I know I had a friend and a mutual friend of ours, Trey Meyer, came up last spring for a few practices, and he sat in with us and he told me he learned a ton in just the 2 days he was there. And it's pretty remarkable the minds you're around in the NBA and how much basketball they've watched. And the thing that's really neat about it is our, you know, the players are really smart and they'll make, you know, great comments throughout the film. So we try to make it as interactive as possible and give them the freedom to talk and talk to their teammates and talk back to the coach, so we're all on the same plane, and it's very synergistic.
Who's been like the most impressive NBA player you've been around in that regard, in terms of just like picking stuff up and like almost being a coach on the floor and just blown away by their basketball IQ?
Well, he just left our team, but the guy who I've worked with closely on our team the last few years, Aaron Baines, who's now at the Celtics. He recognizes situations quickly with his mind. His communication is on point. It's loud. It's repetitive. Everybody knows that they can count on Aaron. And I think that's a big thing when you're building trust, is that, you know, he's accountable to himself and you can count on him. I think Aaron Baines, you know, even in those film sessions, coach will ask a question or an assistant coach will ask a question, or even there was a film session last year where coach let me run it, and Aaron Baines knew the answer before anybody. And it's almost like nine times out of 10, Aaron will shout out the answer before anybody. He's pretty impressive.
Is that common for Coach Van Gundy to let different assistants run film, or is, so he's not the only voice
yeah.
in there?
Correct. Yeah, that's a big deal. You know, our associate head coach Bob Beyer leads a lot of the film sessions. He's kind of our defensive specialist. So if, you know, if we played a team last night and we split the edit up in offense and defense, you know, coach might decide to talk about the defense, but usually he'll let Coach Beyer do it. And then different assistants on their scouts, they're showing the film of the teams they prepared for. You know, they make their edits, how to attack certain teams, how to guard certain teams. So they'll go through all that. Yeah, it's not just one voice. It's multiple.
TJ, I know you're always like tinkering with stuff and like, you know, playing with X's and O's and always have something you got your mind wrapped around. What are you thinking about these days? What's on your mind?
You know what? Honestly, this summer, obviously we know in the NBA, the analytics break it down. Free throws, layups, and threes, corner threes to be specific, are the best shots on offense that we can take. And then, and my mind kind of always is gone towards offense and offensive attack and how to score and how to set guys up the best and get the best shots. So one of the things I did this summer is I just watched the top four teams in the league in how they get corner threes. Okay. And so I literally for about a week in May, I just watched every single attempt and just charted it and charted it and charted it. And again, that's what I'm saying. Like the magic sometimes is in the work. And I actually found, you know, once you chart it and you put it, you know, you categorize everything and how you actually get those, I found, you know, a different hierarchy of situations that come up, you know, natural organic situations that come up in any basketball game, college or NBA or high school. And what I then tried to do is reverse engineer a way to play or an offense around those situations to get those best shots. And that has been what I've been doing for the past 3 months. And I think I've definitely got a start on it. And it's something that we're going to talk about next week in our meetings, but it's something that, you know, I that's what I've been doing for 3 months is trying to figure out to reverse engineer an offense around getting the best shots.
Can you share like a little bit of what you've come up with or at least some of the natural situations that you think occur that lead to, this is all leading to corner threes, right?
Well, it's funny. I started out like that because I wanted to see how you get the corner threes, but in doing that, it's funny to get them the highest percentage way to get them. You put your guys in a certain driving situation. You actually have, you know, it's the old sink stuff, a sink situation where you have your shot, you have a dump off, or you have the skip to the corner three. And that, you know, what I found was the highest percentage way that those teams get those. And so that's great in knowing that, but can you as a coach, you know, intentionally organize part of your offense to get those situations come up when you can call them, you know, based on your alignment and putting a play in or a set or an offense, whatever the case may be. But that's the highest volume on. I'm not going to tell you how high a volume and how the rest of them are divvied out, but, you know, sync situations from what I found is the highest way to get those.
Do you think the best way to get those is it personnel based? You know, it just depends on what you got on your team, or, I mean, so like if you've got a shooter maybe running them off a pin down, you can get those same situations where you got the dump off or your own shot or the kick.
Yeah,
or
if for you're, sure.
So it's just really what you got, you know, you derive it on personnel.
Yeah, I think you can derive it on personnel. I think what you just said, actually, that's one way to do it is you run just a single pin down, you know, corner pin down for a guy who's a good shooter. And then what's the defense going to do on a guy who's a good shooter? They're not going to gap it, so they're going to trail it, right? And so one of the things you can do is as they trail and he comes around, you're creating a natural drive. But the other thing you got to worry about is the point guard or whoever you put up on the top making the pass, his man stunting or swiping in into that gap. So one of the things you got to be cognizant of, if you're going to run something like a catch and shoot or anything that's coming to the middle of the floor where the nail is, you know, one of the things I'm going to try to propose is let's say, you know, you call the play. I would start running the play right as the point guard is coming across half court because his man will be closer to him then. And if you start running the play like floppy or the pin down, right as you're coming across half court, that means X1 is going to be a lot farther away from the basket, let alone the nail. So as you make your pass off the pin down or floppy, there won't be anybody there to stunt. Whereas if you call the play from the top of the key, he's in perfect position to clog it up. So part of it is like, okay, the concept works, but then you got to look and see what happens in real games and see what the timing is and how that's going to work. And one of the things I would recommend, you know, doing is, do you know, for all the coaches out there listening, do you know the time it takes to run each of your plays, you know, based on shot clock, based on short clock, if it goes out of bounds? I think that's a big deal in timing your plays, especially like late game side outs, things that take a while to manifest.
So knowing like how long it takes to execute it, basically.
Correct. Yeah.
Do you think that's realistic to run the plays like as they're crossing half court in terms of like, are guys down the floor and like set and ready to run a play by then?
I think they should be. You know, if we're going to run a play like that, for instance, our system, you know, if we get a stop on defense and we rebound the ball and push it, we're not going to run a set. So we're just going to play our flow game and play. And it's kind of our way of giving the players the freedom after they've earned a stop to play the game. Now, ball goes in the basket, four-man inbounds, that we bring it down. You know, the other guys are supposed to sprint down. And yeah, I think they can be there. I just think, and you know, maybe the point guard can walk it up, but as long as he's engaged his man in that little situation at half court and he's away from the top of the key, then I think you're more able to get catch and shoots without a stuntman. Now, the counter to that is, if you're on defense, anytime you hear a play call where the other team's going to run type of a floppy situation, you should probably back all the way up, right? So there's always – that's the best part about, in my opinion, NBA basketball and basketball in general, is the escalation. You know, I do something. Adam Gordon counters it. I counter that. Adam Gordon counters that. And we just keep escalating upwards and pushing each other, and the competition gets better. It just – the competition drives you to be at your very best, and that's what I like the most about coaching.
All right. I feel like the NBA, but college too, I mean, all basketball is just like 90% ball screens now. Maybe that's a little high, but there's a lot of ball screens. What's the best way? How do you like to guard them?
Well, I'll go back to what you said. It's all about the personnel. You know, if I guess Kyrie's not on the Cavs anymore, but if Isaiah Thomas is coming in to set a pick and roll when LeBron is handling it, versus Tristan Thompson when Isaiah Thomas is handling it, that's a totally different coverage. So it totally depends on the players involved and usually the area of the court.
All right, so traditional ball screen with a guard handling and a big setting it. And let's say middle of the floor.
Okay. I'm not trying to go too deep here, but can the five man, can he shoot threes?
Let's do it both ways. Let's say first non-shooter, DeAndre Jordan setting the ball screen. And then let's do it where he's maybe not a knockdown shooter, but can make a pick and pop shot.
Right. So if you're coming off, if it's DeAndre Jordan, you know, you're probably going to be in a drop and a deep drop. And what deep drop is basically, if you're setting a spread pick and roll where the other three guys are around the 3-point arc and you're setting a high pick and roll with somebody in DeAndre Jordan, the big's going to be starting no higher than the free throw line, the X big, as the pick and roll is being set. And what that does, as DeAndre Jordan rolls down, the X big is backing up accordingly because he never wants the man to roll behind him. And what the whole point of a drop defense is to take away the low man. So if the guy was up on the pick and roll to try to corral the ball handle, obviously the weak side guy's got to pull in and take the roll, and we all know how that works. But the deep drop is supposed to not have anybody pull in. So actually the X big is responsible for making sure the roll doesn't get behind him, the ball doesn't get to the basket for a layup. So he is actually the low man. He's both in that situation. A big who can shoot, that's
well, hold
a lot
on.
Harder.
Hold on, TJ, sorry. Going back to that. So how do you, like, how do guards just not come right off of it and just knock down jump shots, like left and right?
They could. I mean, the whole point is we're pushing them into the two-point range, and when we're coming off of them trailing with a hand high and contesting from behind, and we're trying to force them into contested two, because, you know, every possession you're not going to force a turnover or a shot clock violation every single possession. So we're trying to force them into the worst shot possible, which is a contested two.
So you're just banking on your guards got to be able to get through that screen and contest, and
yeah.
You live with that.
Yeah, and the analytics of it, over a season, you can't win. Your offense isn't very efficient even if you're making those at a high clip. I think the number, don't quote me on this, but I think to have an efficient top 15 NBA offense with just shooting mid-range twos, you have to shoot like 55 or 56%.
And no one's doing that.
Right. And you know, and then a technique, like, again, guys are going to get hit on screens. We're not going to get through every screen. And a technique we actually practice, if you get nailed on a screen, we actually practice spinning under and then trying to contest late to get back in front.
But you'd prefer them to go over the screen, not go under, correct?
Yeah,
okay.
Correct.
Is it different if you're guarding like a Steph Curry or just somebody who, I mean, are you still living with a contested two? Or a guy like that who's such a high-level shooter, do you prefer him to, you know, are you trying to get him to drive? Or, I mean, obviously he can finish.
Yeah,
he's an MVP.
That's a great question. I mean, he's a heck of a player. And the series, the Western Conference Finals from 2 years ago when they played the Oklahoma City Thunder, I thought if you go back and watch those clips when they would switch onto him, so they'd have like Steven Adams or Ibaka switch onto him, right? And obviously he's quicker and faster and all that. But they would play him, you know, they would play him so close they were trying to get beat. You know, a lot of teams would switch and they'd be so nervous to get beat that he'd just cross them up and shoot a three, which is the last thing you want is him shooting a three.
Right.
But what they would try, they would get so close to him and force him to drive and shoot some type of a floater. And one of the things one of his only weaknesses is when he gets sped up, you know, he leaves his feet a lot to pass, and he's actually pretty turnover prone. And I thought they did an outstanding job of forcing him into the paint. The other defenders would stay fanned to their guys, and they wouldn't help. And sometimes he got all the way for a layup, but they'd force tougher shots, or he'd try to spray it out, and they'd be there to intercept it.
Gotcha. Okay, now you got a big man that can shoot sitting the ball screen.
Much tougher. A lot of times now what you're seeing is a switch, but a term, you know, I don't know if a lot of colleges use this term, it's called a veer back. So let's say you're in that same deep drop of the big who isn't a good shooter. You know, you might be up a little bit more, so you might be at the top of the key rather than the free throw line. And the guard, you know, to your point, you're not going to get through every screen. The guard comes off 100 miles an hour and X1 or X2 just gets smashed, and there's no way he can spin under it. He just can't get back in front. We'll call a veer back. And actually that's basically an emergency switch, and we'll just stay connected to those guys. A lot of times though, like a stretch four, and even now the stretch fives will actually show against good shooters who are good shooting bigs. Cause what that does is you stop the ball handler, so you don't get as much distance from the screen off the pick and roll, and you show, and then you can get back as soon as you can on the pop back if the pass is thrown. If it's a really strung out dribble on the show and he's kind of broken the show, we'll probably full rotate that. Except with a guy like Drummond, we would full rotate from the opposite corner because we don't actually want Andre leaving the paint because he's such a great rebounder.
Okay, interesting. Corner three, going back, taking your mind back to college basketball. Is that the best shot in college basketball as well? I know it's closer in the NBA, but.
I don't know. I honestly can't answer that question. I don't know the analytics of the last 3 years or 4 years of college basketball, so I really can't answer that question.
Are you, what about, all right, post-ups? The analytic numbers are terrible for that, right? But if you got guy that can score down there, I mean, if you got Shaq on your team, you're going to throw him the ball. So what's your thought on post-ups and post touches?
Each guy's different. I think you look at their efficiency. You know, if you throw the ball down low and you can get over 1 point per possession, I still think that's a good shot. A lot of teams, you know, I can't, don't quote me on this too, but I'm pretty sure Golden State might lead the NBA in post-ups, which is kind of ironic, but they don't try to score with their back to the basket out of them. They throw it into like Draymond, or they used to throw it into Bogut a lot, and they will run split game with their guards. And that forces the guards, you know, the ball is to the guard's back because the ball's in the post, and they can either slip, flare, chest, come all the way around. And it's very confusing, and it's really fast because every guy on their team can shoot. And they actually get a lot of layups off post-ups, passes from the post-up. You know, doubling the post is usually not a good idea because at the end of the day, if you force like a hook shot, it's technically a contested two as long as it's not within 0 to 3 feet. And you know, I would mix up doubling guys who I thought I could turn them over. You know, I wouldn't do it all the time, but if I thought, hey, this guy, you know, if we come on a quick double out of a timeout here, maybe we can turn him over. I would probably do something like that. But post ups in general are kind of going the way of the dinosaur right now.
What about, where do you like to double from? You double from the baseline, double from the ball, the other big, who you like to come with?
In the post, I think coming from behind, from the baseline, is the most effective way. You know, because you basically, the guy, let's say a guy's posting up, whatever post-up block he posts up on, usually going middle is his strength. So if he posts up on the left side, he's probably pretty good going to his right hand. If it's a guy like Zach Randolph, who always posts up on the right side block, he's pretty good going middle because he's left-handed. So immediately, on a double team from the baseline, you're taking their strongest thing away. So you're immediately telling them, we're not going to let you do what you like to do the most. And you're shifting over to that side. A guy's coming from the baseline. So now he's turning the way he doesn't want to go. There's a defender coming to him, and the baseline's down there, and he might get under the backboard. I just think it turns guys over a lot. They're not used to it. Not a lot of people do it. I think that's probably the most effective way, bar none.
What you talked about with the Warriors throwing it into the post and then running split games with their guards, is that kind of a new trend in the NBA that guys are starting to do, and you see it kind of seep into college? That's really hard to guard, isn't it?
It's very hard to guard, especially when, you know, Coach Van Gundy makes myself and the other video crew and some of the assistant coaches have to guard our guys out on the court, half court. It's very hard to guard. I get dunked on quite a bit.
I can imagine.
But one of the things, I talked to an assistant coach in the NBA who's on a different team, and I asked him this past season, it was before a game, I said, hey, what do you think is the future of offense? Like, what do you think is the next thing? You know, post-ups are going away, like kind of what you just mentioned, Adam, and what's the next thing? What are we doing next? And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, teams, what is next is always who is on top. So people copy who's winning at that time. And it's funny that you said, you know, the split games are coming back, because Golden State 3 years ago, they were running it all the time. And now Utah runs a variation of it, except they do all their split stuff at the nail. Boston runs a version of it. I mean, you're seeing it a lot. And his answer to that question is people always copy what works. I thought it was simple, but pretty fascinating. Even back, you know, when the Bulls were winning, they, you know, people were trying to put in different parts of the triangle. So that, I just thought that was a pretty unique and fascinating answer, and true.
It all goes in cycles, doesn't it?
It does.
What else, TJ? What else you want to talk about?
Man, well, it's the weekend. I was probably going to go biking later this afternoon. There's a lot of trails around here in Michigan. It's a great place to live. I want to talk to you a little bit about how Rising Coaches was down in Indy. I missed it this year. You know, I went to the first two, obviously, as an attendee, and I saw you this summer in Orlando. But how did Rising Coaches go?
Man, I appreciate you bringing it up. and you were at the first two. We had an unbelievable group of people at those first two conferences. And this conference, I felt like I was back when we started. The group of attendees we had, and every year has been really good, and we've had really good people every single year. I just felt like this group was a little bit special. Not that the other groups weren't, but the guys that came were really sharp and really dedicated and really got along. I think everybody just like clicked, and every year it's magic. You know, it just is. Like, it sounds corny, but you leave that conference with like at least 10 legitimate new friends that love to talk hoops and, you know, are trying to do what you're trying to do. And I don't know, maybe it was just because I got to be more hands-on this year than in the past. Couple seasons, just because of job changes and stuff, but I really got a great vibe from everybody who was there. So it was a blast.
That's great. I feel like, you know, I owe a lot to the organization. You know, I was a young guy when I went out there, you know, student assistant at Belmont. I didn't really know the business that well. And just some of those first 2 year speakers, I mean, guys you hear and the knowledge you take back. You know, I remember the first year you had Dustin Kearns in from Santa Clara. And for some reason that his speech in that first year just kind of stuck with me. And I wrote him a letter after that and worked his camp when he was at Santa Clara. He's now the head coach at Presbyterian College. And he and I have been friends for the last 7 or 8 years. And it's just the fellowship that event, that organization that you guys create among us now, you know, going to Orlando like we did earlier in the summer and just talking shop for a few days. I mean, it's, you can't beat it. You know, it's just a group of people who all want to get better at the game, get better at teaching. I owe you guys a lot. I'll say that.
No, well, we owe you. And you're one of the guys that have been with us from day one and watching your ascension through the profession, and now you're in Detroit and doing big things there, and it's been fun to watch, man, and we appreciate everything you've done for us. And now giving back, that's always my favorite at the conference, when guys who attended come back and speak. And I think you were one of the first, if not the first, to do that. And that's
really,
yeah, and that's always awesome to see, and usually the best speakers. So hopefully you'll continue to come back and share your wisdom with the next generation of guys, even though you're not even 30, so you're probably still in that generation, but certainly in coaching years like dog years, right? So you've been in it for like 10 years now. So